we love sports.
Joe Louis, the greatest boxer ever lived.
Not only do we love sports, but we love to debate sports.
He was bad at Chad Clay. He bad at Sugar Ray. He bad at now. Who that's you? The new boy that got Mike Tyson. Look like a bulldog. He bad at him too. He done whipped Mike Tyson ass. He whipped all their ass.
For the best sports analysis in the triad.
What about Rocky Marciano?
In-depth local coverage of your favorite schools and teams.
Let me tell you something. One ball. Rocky Marciano was good. But compared to Joe Louis, Rocky Marciano ain't.
And, of course, the best sports debate in the triad.
It's Joe Lewis's ass.
Welcome to Tobacco Road Sports Radio.
Joe Lewis was 75 years old when he fought.
You're welcome.
I don't know how old he was. They got it
after. For the best high school football games in the triad every Friday.
Can't touch this.
Live sports talk on everything from ACC to Bowman Gray.
Can't touch this.
The most extensive Carolina Panthers coverage in the triad.
Can't touch this.
Plus your exclusive home for Charlotte Hornets in the triad.
Break it down.
Add in your triad home for North Carolina A&T Athletics, and you've got Tobacco Road Sports Radio, your home for triad sports.
One-on-one down the sideline, Warren caught the ball, 10-5, he's in! Touchdown, Aggies!
You are locked in to Tobacco Road Sports Radio, your home for triad sports.
And you know this, man!
In professional sports, a franchise player is an athlete who is not simply the best player on their team, but one that the team can build their franchise around for the foreseeable future.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Franchise Players here on Tobacco Road Sports Radio, tobaccoroadsportsradio.com. You can catch us in the Triad every Friday afternoon as part of the TGI Friday lineup over on WWBG 1470 AM in Greensboro. If you miss it, you can catch the redo in Winston-Salem on WTOB 980 AM, 96.7 FM at 6 p.m. on Friday. And of course, you can hear it on Friday afternoons on tobaccoroadsportsradio.com. Rate and subscribe the YouTube channel, youtube.com/@Tobacco Road Sports Radio. Lots of good stuff popping over there. And we're just happy that you guys have been along for the ride as we are your source for Triad Sports and Triad Sports coverage. College basketball season ending this past Monday with UConn going back-to-back. So we decided to do an end-of-the-season college basketball blowout show. Very special panel on with us today. First, you might know him from Out of Pocket with Michael Davis. He is the host of Out of Pocket with Michael Davis. Michael Davis in the house with franchise players for this week. And then also special treat, you may have seen them on some of our shows on Tobacco Road the past couple of weeks. Got the Burton boys in the house, Josh and Peyton Burton from Everything College Basketball. If you guys love college basketball and you have not had a chance to go over and check out their podcast, definitely do that. Rate and subscribe their YouTube channel as well. Gentlemen, what's going on? How y'all doing?
Doing fantastic. Hopefully the storm stays at bay and we can talk some college basketball.
Yeah, there's some weather going on in random parts of where everybody is right now.
Yeah, I feel you on that, Michael. My power just flickered about 30 minutes ago, and it took me 30 minutes to get my PC back up and running. So hopefully, fingers crossed, I'll be able to do the show without having power issues.
Yeah, and that'd be good.
And I am fired up, and you will find out why here in just a little bit, I'm sure of it.
Yeah, so this whole idea for this episode spawned off of a social media exchange between all of us where we were kind of debating whether or not the University of Kentucky was the best job in college basketball. And I was like, you know what, we should make that a show or a segment or something. And that developed out to what we're going to do today. It's not going to be the full hour, but we've got a pretty good mix of stuff college basketball-wise today. Top five best college basketball head coaching jobs today. All of us put in our five. We'll see how similar those lists may be. I don't know if anybody's seen anybody else's list except for me seeing all three of yours. So we'll go through those. What else we got going on today? The transfer portal, NIL, good or bad for college basketball? You can look at this a number of ways. So what better panel to have than these three guys here to discuss this, because we're seeing some programs going this way and some programs going that way. And it feels like it's aligned with the portal and NIL. And then something that I always find interesting at the end of each college basketball season, UConn started getting some conversation about being in that best ever elite type group with their back-to-back win and their dominance throughout the past two tournaments in terms of margin of victory. Who is the best college basketball champion of the past 50 years? Very interested to hear these guys' comments, because I'm pretty sure I'm the oldest on this panel again. So around a little bit longer than the other three, but starting out, top five best college basketball head coaching jobs today. Again, this came about with Kentucky now having an opening, and John Calipari basically looks like kind of voluntarily leaving to go to Arkansas in conference in the SEC and take less money to do so, which kind of sparked the debate. So I'm going to try to split this up a little bit. Which one of the Burton brothers want to go first, Josh or Peyton? Josh, I know you've been chomping at the bit to get after
let,
this.
So let him go. Offer. Let him go. He's waiting for
so
it.
So we'll break. So we'll keep this contained and we'll break it down in segments. The first thing you talked about, Cal Bolton for Arkansas. There's more to it. On the surface, it looks like, oh, he leaves, and he called it forever. He called it when he was at Memphis, his dream job. He called it now, even in his Arkansas presser the other day, it was his dream job. So why would you leave your dream job in my, what I consider the best job in college basketball? Well, I mean, been there 15 years, and the results had started to dip. And it's more than just results. There's this narrative out there from non-Kentucky people that are kind of roasting them right now that, well, as soon as you have a bad year or two, they're going to put for sale signs up in your front yard. That's simply just not true. The results are obviously a big thing, but it's your demeanor. It's how you handle the press. It got to the final 5-6 years that Cal had no relationship with local media. He had no relationship with the AD. He had no relationship with the boosters. 99% of his own doing. So it's not just like, oh, you can't have a bad season or two or the people in Lexington will run you out, Big Blue Nation. That's not entirely true. Like, we are very forgiving and we understand bad seasons will happen from time to time. But when you kind of alienate yourself, then that puts pressure on you. So, of course, he didn't feel wanted after this upset loss to Oakland, the second major loss inside the first round the last three seasons. It's just unacceptable. And so he bolted. He found the first opening that he liked and he could go to. He's going to a good spot where he's got rich donors down in Arkansas. So I wanted to clear that up. I guess, Dez, you want to get into the debate, or how do you want to handle this from here?
Well, we'll go do everybody's top five first, and then we'll kind of, because I think we'll be a little surprised at some of the similarities that you guys had with some of your lists. So go ahead and drop your top five in order. Best head coaching college basketball gigs as it stands today, April 11th, 2024.
Yeah, and there's a lot that goes into that, and you got to keep in mind. And I'm close. I feel like I'm close to your age. I'll be 35 here in just a couple months in June.
I'm 46.
Okay, well, so close enough. Closer than these two, right?
I appreciate that.
I've been around the game in all different levels my whole life, and I consider myself a historian. When you talk about the best jobs of college basketball, and you do factor in NIL, transfer portal, and all that, but there's still the name brand. You're talking about history. You're talking about fan base. You're talking about exposure. You're talking about, can coaches go there and cement their legacy even further? All that's wrapped up into one and what makes a good job. Recent results are nice, but it doesn't play much of a factor into what's considered a great job as a whole. And we'll get into it. It's backed by just listening to some of the top coaches of all time talk about it. My top five jobs. This hasn't really changed much over the years. Number one, I've got Kentucky. We're going to talk about it. Number two, I've got North Carolina. North Carolina is the only school, in my opinion, that can have an argument to be number one outside of Kentucky. Again, we will talk about it. Three is Kansas. Four is Duke. The top four are easy. They've been like that forever. To me, they stay like that. The name brands speak for themselves. Number five is where I had a little harder time because there's a bunch of schools you could kind of throw in the mix. Whether they're talking to Louisville, still a great job. Forget the recent results. Indiana, still a great job. Arkansas is a great job. Great fan base. Great, good little history. Michigan State, a couple others. I went UCLA. It's not the UCLA of old, but it's still UCLA with the heritage and the legacy. It's still UCLA. I mean, it's out in LA. It's UCLA with a little bit of money still. I think UCLA is still a very prime destination. So that would be my number five, and that's kind of my top five and how I'd order them in best gigs right now.
Mike, you want to go next?
Yeah, I will. And it's interesting because when I sat down and thought about it and I, you know, did my research and stuff, Josh's top four is pretty much a unanimous top four, consensus top four across the board. And it's very similar to mine as well. Of course, I have Duke at number one. And the reason I have Duke number one is there's a consistency there. Coach K's been there for 35, 40 years, and then they follow up with a player, a former player of his who was in his coaching tree. John Shire could have left and went to another school, but he knew that there was a prestigious opportunity at Duke once Coach K retired, and that's why that's kept going. You know where you're playing at. They've kept it at Cameron Indoor Stadium rather than rebuilding and expanding the arena. UNC's at two. I think Duke UNC will always be the 1-2 blue bloods of college basketball. And even with the games they play, like it's national news, like it's national coverage. Everybody can't wait for Duke Carolina. It's probably the best rivalry in all sports. Kentucky, I have at three. The reason that Kentucky wouldn't be one or two is if it was the best job in the world, then we would have already filled out a coach and John Calipari wouldn't be going to Arkansas and other coaches wouldn't be turning down to stay where their respective schools is, like the Alabama's coach or UConn's coach. Kansas is at four, and then UConn. I've put UConn here. I almost put UCLA here, and Josh putting UCLA at five. I have that respect for the history and the legacy with UCLA, but for UConn and what they're doing both in the women's program and the men's program, I know we're specifically talking about the men's program, but back to back championship runs, and Dan Hurley's like, I'm not leaving UConn. This is the best place to be. So if we're asking this question on April 11th, 2024, UConn's gotta be number five.
Peyton.
Oh, boy. Okay, I did not expect this to start off this early, but I guess I'll go ahead. Josh, hit me with that hot tag. I'm ready to go.
Welcome, my top, players.
My top four is exactly what Josh's top four is. Kentucky one, Carolina two, Kansas three, Duke four. I actually agree with Michael. I have Connecticut fifth. Recent history from 99 to now, they've won six national titles. They're in the Big East Conference. There are rumors that they could be moving to the Big 12 Conference here soon. We'll see, which that's obviously the best conference college basketball has been for the last couple of years. Great history, great tradition, three different coaches with three different national championships, Kevin Ollie, Jim Calhoun, and now Dan Haley. First team since Florida to go back-to-back. I think they should be on this list. Duke, the reason I have them four behind Kansas, Carolina, and Kentucky. You mentioned Coach K. Outside of him, that's really it for the whole coaching tree for Duke. Before he got there, they weren't even remotely on the same level as North Carolina. You look at North Carolina, you look at Dean Smith, you look at Larry Brown, you look at Roy Williams. That's three Hall of Fame coaches that coach at Carolina, and they all did really good success down there. You look at Duke, it is Coach K, and that is it. John Shire has done well in his first couple of years, but it's way too early to see if he's even going to be a Hall of Famer or a future Hall of Famer. So that's why I have him fourth. Kansas, listen, I got my Kansas gear on. It's the best home court advantage in the country. I don't know how people can argue that. Allen Feldhouse, Fog Allen. You mentioned the heritage of Kansas basketball, the program, from the people that played there to the coaches. It's probably the richest heritage of all time in college basketball. Dean Smith played there, and it was the assistant coach. That was his first coaching gig there. Adolph Ruff played there. Then you look at Bill Self, you look at Roy Williams, Larry Brown, Fog Allen. Like, it's ridiculous. Roy Williams, that's five different, like, Hall of Famers. Dr. James Naismith, who is the only coach, by the way, at Kansas basketball history to have a losing record, which is ridiculous. Yeah. Instead, he invented the game. But still, he's still on that list. It's incredible. And then as far as Kentucky goes, you said if it really was the best job in the country, why would Cal leave for Arkansas? Why would they haven't filled the coaching position yet? And there's a couple reasons why. Josh mentioned with Cal, he didn't want to leave Kentucky. He wanted to stay at Kentucky. The reason he left Kentucky is because he basically got pushed out of Kentucky by the fan base. By the fan base. Yeah, by the fan base. Even when there was rumors that he was going to take the Arkansas job. He got cold feet, and he was trying to negotiate with Mitch Barnhart. That connection soured throughout the years. That's not really on Cal's fault. If he had the choice, he would have stayed at Kentucky for the rest of his career, and he would have retired. As far as the coaching position goes, why they haven't gotten a coaching job yet or replaced him yet, Dan Hurley, he fits the Northeast better than anybody. He's at the perfect spot right now in UConn. They offered him $100 million, and he turned that down because his wife wanted to stay at Connecticut.
Happy wife.
Same with Scott Drew. Yeah. Scott Drew, if it was up to him, he mm-hmm. would to came to Kentucky. But his wife, who is very, very a big introvert, loves down there in Waco, Texas. The pressure of it is not even remotely close. That's the reason they didn't accept the job. Carolina's the only team in this list that can compare with Kentucky for the top job.
And let me add to that, too. He is right, too, about Scott Drew and Dan Hurley, because more reports have been coming out. The other night, Scott Drew, when it kind of like, hey, he may become Kentucky's head coach, he sent his family to Lexington. He had already made his mind up. He wanted the job. There's a whole bunch of insider reports that we follow, sources that say Scott Drew, if it was left up to his own devices, would be the coach at Kentucky right now. But he's a family man, and he's also super religious. Waco's a big, like, religious town, too. And his family, his wife, they have kids in high school. They have one in college that goes to Baylor. He just didn't want to uproot and leave. But Scott Drew himself would have taken it had it been up to him solely. Same with Dan Hurley. Dan Hurley was mega interested, but the wife does not want to leave the Northeast. He's got all of his family up there. So, again, it's easy to say, well, why haven't they got a coach if it's such a big job and it's the best job? If you ask these guys, and the reports are coming out, they would have taken it if it was solely them. If they were single men and they didn't have a wife and a kid, they would be at Kentucky.
I'm hearing butts. I'm hearing butts right now. Let me ask this question before I go into my list. What would you say is the top coaching job in college football?
Bama?
Yes. The Windhorn. Bama. It's Bama, right? Bama, Nick Saban retires. How long does it take Alabama to replace Nick Saban?
Let me ask you this, though, too.
Not long.
Alabama's got probably the best tradition of all time in college football, right? Before they got Nick Saban, you realize he was their third or fourth option. They tried to get Rich Rod from West Virginia. So if Alabama's the best football tradition, they had struggles, too. And they didn't even want to get Nick Saban until he's like their third option. So, it's easy to cast off Kentucky, but trust me, they're going to end up with somebody. Kentucky.
Really, I understand. See, I think the problem here with the conversation is that we're misconstruing the word best job with prestigious job. Like, I think Kentucky's one of the most prestigious jobs in the country in college basketball for everything you just said. The question is not that, though. The question remains the same. Which is the best job right now in college basketball? And I don't believe it's Kentucky. I do have Kentucky in my top five, but I have reasons for where I have them. I do have North Carolina at number one. For one of the reasons, North Carolina and Duke are in a situation where their biggest rival is 8 miles apart from each other. That does not exist anywhere in the country. That electricity, that game is the most watched college basketball game, regular season game, every single year, Carolina-Duke. Carolina has proven they can win with multiple coaches, and Carolina has a succession tree. We talked about this one Out of Pocket on Monday. The one thing that's holding Kentucky back is that every 10 or 15 years, you guys have to reset, like literally from ground one, because there's no succession. There's no coaching tree. Calipari, during these 15 years, should have been grooming someone to replace him so they could continue to play the way he would want to play at Kentucky. But instead, what's going to happen, they're going to have to bring in a fresh face like they did when they brought in Calipari. You know, and the cycle repeats. For every Tubby Smith, there's a Billy Gillespie. Whereas at Carolina, it's been championships and winners since the 50s, all the way up to now. Like, there's the only drop-off you can really say is Matt Daugherty, and that was for 2 years. And even with Matt Daugherty, the recruiting class he brought in won a national championship for Roy Williams 2 years later. So, like, there's levels to it. There's differences to it. Kentucky deserves to be on the list, top five head coaching gigs, just because of their past, their history, what they've won. I know the fan base is rabid. There's a lot of things that go into it. But on the other hand, I'm hearing people upset with the AD right now for how he's handling the situation. You mentioned the pressure to be the Kentucky head coach in that state. There's nothing in there. There's nothing in Kentucky to do but watch Kentucky and Louisville basketball. There's no pro teams. There's nothing else. So that pressure is a little bit different, I would say, than Duke and Carolina, although the pressure here is tremendous. You're following legends here as opposed to following whoever came before you at Kentucky. Number two, I have Kansas for the same reasons. Best home court in the country. Kansas and North Carolina are just intricately intertwined in terms of their histories. You don't leave Carolina in Kansas unless A, you're retiring, B, you suck, like Mac Daugherty, or three, you're leaving to go to the other one, Roy Williams. There's no other, you don't leave to go someplace else in the Big 12 to coach. You don't leave to go to Virginia to coach against Carolina. That just doesn't happen. So as much as I'd want to put Kentucky higher on my list, I can't, because that does happen where they don't, somewhere along the way, they have not thought of what do we do if this coach doesn't work out down the road? We'll just go pick the biggest name we can find. And they never thought about, well, what if that big name doesn't want to come here? And that's where they're at right now. So I can't put Kentucky there for those reasons. Duke kind of already went through it. They're my number three, although I have them at three because they were the first school in the country to start an NIL basically department and have basically a general manager. Like, they've been ahead of the game on all this, along with Carolina, really from the get-go. They just haven't really used the transfer portal. And the more I thought about it, it's like, maybe it's because it's hard to get in the Duke. Maybe it's hard to transfer credits to Duke. Maybe that's why they don't use the portal and they just don't want to say it out loud. Duke is three. Kentucky's four. My surprise, actually, number five is Michigan. And I thought about this because in terms of best jobs, like right now, Juwan Howard fumbled the bag. He had a great situation going on. Think of the buzz when Juwan Howard first came into Michigan as the head coach. They were a national brand again. They made it to the national championship game. Like, Michigan has money. Michigan has money. And, like, they could basically run the Big Ten if they could get their stuff together. They're kind of dormant. I put them in the same category as UCLA, Louisville, NC State, Indiana, where it's like they could be a blue blood if they really wanted to. If they really put forth the effort to try to be in that category, they have the pedigree, they have the history, they've got rings and everything else. But they're in a lull right now. And if I had to pick between UCLA and all these others in terms of best job opportunity, like the best opportunity to expand and build the brand, right now it'd be Michigan, because UConn, to be honest, has kind of, can they get any bigger than where they are right now? Like, I mean, Dan Hurley's
back-to-back champions.
I mean, they're the best team in the country.
That's great.
In 2 years, but like, the program's also great.
The programs on, like, the last 25 years, I mentioned this the other day on our show, they're the ultimate all or nothing program.
Yeah.
Especially since 1999, they're either going to win the title or they're going to flame out miserably, probably not even make the title or the championship. So that's why it's hard to judge. The titles obviously raise them up. And when they get to the Final Four, they're like, what did we say the other day, Peyton? Since 1999, they've lost one time in the Final Four. They're like 23-1 in the Final Four.
Yeah.
But in between years, it's really bad. Like, it's really bad stuff from UConn in the in-between years. So they're very much the definition of an all or nothing program. It's hard too, because if you look at their financials, UConn athletics right now is struggling for cash. Like, I know they're giving Hurley a big pay raise as he deserves, mm-hmm. but if you look as a whole, like, their football team's epically awful, does not draw well. Their sports as a whole does not draw. And I think that's in part why they're trying to get out of the Big East again for a second time to go to the Big 12, where the money's going to be at. So if Dan Hurley leaves UConn at some point to go coach the New York Knicks, which is kind of his ultimate goals from what I'm hearing, they will get a good coach. But again, they had to pull Dan Hurley from Rhode Island. They had to pull Jim Calhoun from, was it Boston U back in the day?
It's like hit or miss. They're bringing up guys. Yeah.
They don't pull big names. They pull guys from the mid-major that has somewhat of a name and hope to develop him or allow him to develop.
Kentucky, other schools don't do that. Kentucky doesn't do that. Carolina, they're within.
And let me give you another thing real quick on Kentucky. The only school to have five different coaches win national championships. We've won eight of them. The only school to have five. The next closest is UConn with three and then North Carolina with three. That's it. We've had five different ones. And the point being why I say that, coaches do not have better records. That, like, their best run as a coach is when they coach with Kentucky outside of Billy Gillespie. And that's just in case if you're a wild drunk, no offense, Billy. But I mean, Rick Pitino made a Final Four at Providence. He coached and won a national title at Louisville. He coached the Boston Celtics. His best run was in the 90s with Kentucky. Joby Hall obviously succeeded Adolph. Rupp doesn't really count because he kind of started this whole thing.
Yeah.
Joby Hall succeeded Rupp. Never had another job, but he won a title, made a couple Final Fours. Even Eddie Sutton, who made a Final Four at Oklahoma State in his 3 years before the probationary period and got him in trouble, that was like his best three-year run consistently when he was at Kentucky. John Calipari made Final Fours, but his best runs at Kentucky. The point being, coaches do not leave Kentucky or anywhere else prior or after and have a better run than they do at Kentucky. it's proven that you can come there, win national championships, no matter where you're at.
But that's again, not really goes, the question, though. Like we know,
but it goes back to the best, though, because of the resources, because of everything that you have to succeed there. Nobody spends more money on college basketball alone than the University of Kentucky. You have everything you ever need to be there. The only thing that scares people away potentially is like the crazed fan base, the pressure.
That's where I'm going to. Doesn't that make it a negative on the job?
It does. We've always said, and you'll understand this because we are a little older. Certain people are built for that job. It has been said for years because it is such a prestigious, high profile job. You can't have just a calm level guy for the most part. You need somebody who can be great basketball mind, great recruiter, part politician to handle it. And when things are great, your legacy is built forever. No matter where you've been before, if you win at Kentucky, same way if you win at Carolina, your legacy is way up in the sky, right? But if you lose, you got to be able to handle it too. So there is a pressure. You have to be a certain type of person and a coach to withstand that and understand what you're getting yourself into. So yes, it can be a negative. And I think for Scott Drew too, even though it has came out that if it was up to him solely, he would have been the next coach. I do think it did worry him a little bit. I think it worried him a little bit that like, man, what if we have like a losing season? Are they going to whatever? So I think there's positives and negatives, but those who are crazy and are obsessed with being the best, those are the types that do really, really well at a place like Kentucky.
But those guys are already at Carolina, Duke, and Kansas. Like, that's kind of my point. Yep. Like you can't
see, and UConn.
You can't say both ways. Like, again, we're not arguing if Kentucky is a good program. That's not the question. The question is the job the best job today in college basketball? And I got to say no, because coaches keep leaving. Like, it feels like they get burnt out, because Tubby Smith was kind of the same way, like towards the end, where it just – the grind of having to carry a state on your shoulders for a college where, I mean, you're getting death threats for losing to like Presbyterian in December, like in a non-conference game. If you're the head coach at Kentucky, like it's just the fan base is just a different type of level. Now, granted, me and Mike live in North Carolina and we know rabid fan bases from Carolina and Duke, especially when they have to face off against each other. There's not a whole lot of difference there. I know a lot of people want to say Kentucky's like up here fan base wise. Carolina Duke is up there too. They have been consistently because they've got things to check for. But I just feel like with Kentucky, this is going to be really important, who they hire and what happens next to me. Because if they can actually hire somebody and build a program where there's succession after that person, then I'll give them leeway toward, okay, they're building something where they, not only will somebody want to come there, it's somebody who's been there and actually understands Kentucky and can actually navigate that pressure. You're bringing in outsiders that don't know how to handle it. I think that's why it works at Carolina. They've been there. They played there. They were coaches there, whatever. They understand the Carolina fan base. You mentioned it earlier, Josh. It remains to be seen, or it might have been Peyton. It remains to be seen with Duke, because we've only known 40 years of Coach K. That we haven't seen. There was Vic Bubas before him, but other than that, they haven't really had success, except unless it was K sitting on the bench. And then these past 2 years with Shire, he hasn't been there long enough for us to know if their succession plan works. Out of all these schools we said, the only school that actually has had a succession plan and it's worked over 50 years is North Carolina, but from Frank McGuire to Dean Smith to, Matt Daugherty to Roy Williams to Hubert Davis now. Like, there's been a plan who's going to be next, and it kept the level where it was.
Let me ask you something real quick, too, about Hubert Davis, because
sure,
there is obviously with, again, I say if anybody's going to make the argument over Kentucky, I would give it North Carolina for all the reasons we've already laid out. But Hubert Davis just wrapped up year three, about to go into year four. Year one, he found himself in the national championship game. Now, they were not great that whole year, but got hot at the right time. Then year two, if you remember, and I know you do, just this last season, they were not good at all. They had problems internally. And Carolina fans, I didn't know you back then, but from when we cover college basketball, we know Carolina fans personally. We know them all across the country. They were questioning if Hubert was going to be in the hot seat coming into year three after 2 years.
They were.
Coming.
Yeah, they are all
so,
quiet now.
So we can't. So there we go. We can't talk about Kentucky's, well, they'll run him out of town. They were ready to run Hubert out of one bad season coming off of a national championship game appearance where they came within 3 points of winning in his first year. And well, then turn around and say because the succession
too
plan.
With Hubert, because A, Hubert's the first African-American coach in Carolina history. So he's up against the wall to begin with. Two, that wasn't his team. That was still Roy Williams' recruits. Those first years, he was on the
staff to help bring in, though. It's not like he wasn't on the staff for what, like,
no, he helped recruit years. Them, but they were Roy Williams' last two recruiting classes, pretty much, that he was using. It wasn't hit this year that we just saw at Carolina. That was the first time Hubert had a chance to build a team himself, and he did it out of the portal, out of, you know, freshmen coming in, reclassified Cadeau so he could be there, that kind of thing. But again, Carolina was preseason. We didn't think they should be preseason number one to start off with last year, because we remembered we weren't very good until the last 2-3 weeks of the season.
Got hot. Right time.
Yeah, we got super hot and got lucky. We didn't see Kentucky in that bracket because they lost early.
We got beat
and beat Duke. It was storybook. And
that Baylor game, by the way, off topic, that Baylor game, you guys, I thought you were going to blow it because you went up with 20, yes. And then Baylor came back, sent overtime, but that was a crazy run.
I think they got fouled out. I think somebody else. I think Manic fouled out too, or something. Yeah, RJ went off. Yeah,
Manic was phenomenal that whole term. But then, let's flip this to Duke as well, though. If people remember and look up history wise, Duke would make the occasional run from basically 1940 all up till Coach K got there, and was it 1980, 1981, whenever that was.
79, I think is when he first got there.
Josh, be careful, man. Be careful. Know what you're talking about.
Look, come on, man. I'm a historian here, okay?
I've been here
for a while. Okay. Like, for instance, in 1978, Kentucky beats them in the national title game. But their history leading up to that was not great, right? They relied on Coach K. And if you remember, Coach K's like first 4 or 5 years was not good. And if it had been modern basketball, he would have been fired, and we would have never known this run at Duke.
Yes.
The AD was very patient with Virginia one of those years in the ACC tournament. By like
Ralph Sampson and all of them.
Yeah, like it was bad in the very beginning.
The AD was very patient with him, and then he paid off for him. But their whole identity essentially is tied to one man. Now, Shire, I think through his first couple of years, is doing fine. I mean, getting to the Elite Eight this past year was a great accomplishment. He's a great recruiter, but we've still got to see it. The problem being, look at Syracuse is what I'm getting at. Their whole identity for 46 years was tied to Jim Boeheim.
Yep.
That's a hard follow when you tie your whole identity of your program being elite, and Duke's elite. I'm not saying they're not. They're definitely elite, but we've still got to see it. And so I've seen Michael's comment about we didn't need six different coaches. That's not necessarily the flex you think it is. To me, it proves that, like, Kentucky and North Carolina, these different places that can win with multiple coaches, that's history right there. That's legacy.
Yeah, I'm going to say like that. They can win with multiple coaches. Yeah. That is a sign that it's a place where if you've got the proper facilities and the proper things in place, you can win at Kentucky. Yeah. That's been proven time and time again with different coaches, different styles, different players, different methods of bringing in teams and building. But again, like I said, that wasn't really the question. The question was, if you had to choose today, like, what's the best job, which would it be? And as much I know you love Kentucky, but right now I would have to say Kansas and Carolina would be, if they were all three sitting in front of me, like, we want you to come here and coach. Kansas, Carolina, Kentucky. I'm picking Carolina. Like, it's just, there's just too many positives to go with it. Or Kansas, to be honest. Like, I don't see Bill Self coaching anywhere else. He's going to retire at Kansas. You know, Hubert's going to retire at Carolina. Shire's going to retire at Duke, unless he's not, you know, good. But I don't see any of that happening anytime. He's bringing in top number one recruiting classes still in today's day and age. I just need an executive decision. We're going to go for the entire hour. So.
Here's the thing, though. Like, you guys are saying, like, Duke's having Coach K for 40 so years is like a negative. That's a positive. Like, if I went to a job and was like, hey, we're going to stick by you, especially when the starting years are rocky, but we're going to believe in you and you're going to have job security for the next 40 years. No other program promises that.
Like, well, that won't happen today either, though. Like, I don't think you would have a situation where you'd have a guy. Hell, he came from, what was it, Air Force? Was he coaching Air Force? And he had a losing record there.
Sorry, not Air Force, it was the Army. Army.
Yeah. Wherever he was coaching at before, he had a losing record when Duke hired him. So it wasn't like Duke was losing anything by let's see what he does. Let's get him through his first recruiting class.
And it shows again to Duke.
Like,
and it showed again too. They gave him that because he was slowly showing progression, and that showed where Duke's program was. Their whole identity, and I'm not meaning this mean because Duke is elite, but their whole identity to this point. It's tied to one man.
I agree.
It's tied to one man, where as opposed to Kansas, Kentucky, North Carolina have done it for 80 some years with various coaches winning at the highest of highest level. That's why Duke is fourth all time in wins. That's why they're fourth.
Most of them, 1,100 of them are K.
Because up until the last 40 some years, well, we'll say 35 is when he really started to get it going. they didn't have that many great winning seasons. Carolina, Kentucky, Kansas did. That's why you see them at the top of every chart and every metric possible outside of national championships. But that's because John Wood, there's a whole nother discussion there. He was cheating back in the day.
But if the question is today, like, we can't look back at 40 years when Coach K accepted that job originally.
And like, that's why today, I did my top five, because of Coach today, the stuff I laid out, they have an NIL program. They've kind of figured out the recruiting thing. They're going to always have a top five recruiting class if Shire's the one leading the recruiting. So that's there. You're going to have talent coming in. But you do play in a facility that only seats 10,000 people. You do have your rival 8 miles down the street. And they have been having more success over the past couple of years in terms of winning things, including beating you. So it's like, that's why Carolina, I could put them ahead, and the longevity of what they've done. But I want to move on again. Like I said, we're going to make this commercial free. We'll go a little bit early to appease some of our advertisers here at the very end. But we're going to just stay here to the top of the hour. I want to flip over to best college basketball champion in the past 50 years. What team stands out to you? So we're going all the way back to 1984. 1974. So a lot to pick here. I have a feeling I know who Mike's going to pick. Maybe I know who Josh is going to pick too.
It's hard for me to pick.
Maybe Peyton too. So
it's hard for me to pick one. I'll just give you some of the teams.
Okay.
Because I think there's a category like
you got to pick one. Come on now.
Oh well, now narrow it down.
You got to pick one.
Give us one. Who's
we'll
the
be
one
here forever.
Who's the one team you would not want Kentucky to see? That you saw as a national champion over the course of your lifetime.
Okay, so let me say this real quick. Up until this year, I always said the greatest team I ever seen was the 1996 Kentucky team. 9 pros, Antoine Walker, Ron Mercer, Tony Delk, Walter McCarty. They had the highest point difference, or the point difference, yeah, I think I'm saying that right.
Yeah.
And basically beating opponents by a wide margin up until this year, until UConn finally passed it some almost 30 years later. Like, that was the most incredible team that I've ever seen. UConn this year has a place in probably that top 10 for sure. I mean, you got Carolina in 09. You got the Florida back-to-back teams. UNLV 90 with the running Rebs. I mean, Indiana in 87. Like, you've got so many teams. So to narrow it down to one is extremely hard for me. You know, I'll just keep Homer. 96 Kentucky.
I don't know that.
Rick Pitino, 9 pros on that team. Keep in mind, you had pros who could not even get into practices that year. You had pros and Scott Padgett and them who ended up being one of the best players in the 98 team that won the title. Mm-hmm. And 96 couldn't even get on the practice floor.
Yeah.
That's how loaded they were. They played a fun style, pressing you up and down the floor, blowing teams out.
Yeah, they were good.
I'll stay with the 96 team, but that is a little biased just because I can't narrow it down to one. So I'll just say, my Cats in 96.
I was a senior in high school in 96, so I remember that Kentucky team very fondly. And Mirk Pitino, you mentioned him earlier on in the show. The thing that messed up for Pitino is that the Celtics didn't land Tim Duncan with the number one overall pick. That's what screwed him up, because that was the sell. That's why he left. Otherwise, I think he'd still be at Kentucky to this day. You know, like, I think he'd still be your head coach. And the problem we were talking about before would have been solved. He would have had a tree and everything else going on. Mike, I already know who it is, I think, but give me the best college basketball champion of the past 50 years.
So I'm not going to go Homer pick.
Oh,
I'm not going to go Duke.
What? Really? Wow. I'm shocked here. Are you sure?
I'm sure. I'm okay. Sure. Because, and this might be recency bias, just like our wrestling fans are like, WrestleMania 40 is the greatest mania of all time. But how can you bank against UConn and what they just did?
This UConn, like, this year?
This year's UConn. First of all, to be a defending champion, and we were on out of pocket, and everyone was unanimous of like, we haven't seen a champion go back to back in years. As a matter of fact, our defending champions don't make it past the first weekend. But UConn not only beat teams, but they beat them decisively. There was not one game, and that helps with margin of victory. There was not one game to where you looked and you're like, they won this game because of the refs. The refs helped them. Circumstances helped them. Injuries to other teams helped them. Like, there was no, like, asterisks to this UConn team. And to go back-to-back in this day and age and to, you know, run the gauntlet, basically, and then go up against a one-seed Purdue in the championship game and make it feel like Zach Edey wasn't doing what he was doing the entire tournament. Like, I'm not a UConn guy, okay? But you cannot doubt that with their margin of victory being the highest in March Madness history. Like, they did something impressive. They did something remarkable. And maybe I'm, you know, 6-8 months removed from this, and I'm like, eh, maybe it was actually this other team. But I was so impressed. They were unstoppable.
Peyton, I'll address Michael's ridiculous here in a bit.
Not out of pocket. Peyton, it's not out of pocket.
Your thoughts here?
This is tough. I think I'm at. It's funny to me, like you mentioned, Rick Pitino. If he didn't leave, if he probably would be still at Kentucky right now, and he probably would have. And also, if he was still at Kentucky right now, not only would they have a couple more championships, but sorry, Michael, but your beloved Coach K, Rick Pitino, if he would have stayed at Kentucky, would be the all-time wins leader. And it's not even a debate. He would have won. It's not baloney.
His win percentage. I mean, Dez knows this. The way Pitino was winning in the 90s was almost unprecedented.
Yeah, he was recruiting very well also. He was using the Kentucky machine the way it was meant to be used. Mm-hmm. Like, basically, he understood what it was. He came in and did it exactly the way Kentucky fans wanted him to. And, again, the only reason why he left is because he was pretty much assured he was going to get Tim Duncan as the number one pick in the draft. And then they didn't get the number one pick. The Spurs got it, and he'd already accepted the job. And he ended up with I forgot who it was they drafted, but it wasn't Tim Duncan.
He had, like, Chauncey Billups. He got Antoine Walker. Ron Mercer and all them,
It's not the same as Timmy.
But anyways, I imagine if Kentucky would have won the title in 2015, like they probably should have, then I'd probably say that's the best team I've ever seen, period. But best team in recent memory, I don't know if it's all time, but in recent memory, I mentioned it last week, and I'm actually going to agree with Michael. I think this UConn team should be out there. The adversity they had to go through coming into this year. They won the national title 2 years ago in 2022, ran through the whole field as a 4 seed. They lost 4 to 5 players, key players from that year's squad coming into this year. Still was ranked top 5 in the country, had a battle through adversity. A lot of people thought they were overrated. Donovan Klingon should not be ranked as a top 5 preseason player of the year, should not be ranked that high when he didn't really play all that all behind Sanogo a couple seasons ago. And then the only non-conference game that they've lost in the last 2 years was at Kansas this season, when Tristan Newton still had 32 points and they lost by 6 at the Fog Allen, which I mentioned earlier, the toughest place to play in the country. They went through this tournament. They trailed a total of 4 minutes in this year's NCAA tournament, and that whole 4 minutes was in the Final Four against Alabama. They made a hard tournament look very, very easy. They played this NCAA tournament on rookie mode, and what they did to Purdue in the championship game to Zach Edey, who still had 37 points in that game, they shut everybody else down, and they didn't do it by hitting a lot of threes. They shot like a total of 30% from the three-point line, consisting of 6 games, and they still went through everybody. Like, it's remarkable. They have a chance to have 5 pros in the starting lineup. We'll wait and see what happens there. They're going to lose the majority of that. First team since Florida to go back-to-back. I agree with Michael. I think UConn should be up there in conversation.
So, to me, and all those are great choices, and again, I'm the old head on the panel, so I've seen a lot of teams, especially in the 90s and the 80s in particular. The greatest team I've ever seen is 1990 UNLV, hands down. Like, they are the one team. I said it in the tournament. Yeah, when the tournament began, I was like, UConn's the one team I don't want Carolina to play again, because we played them earlier in the year, and when the game was over, they were the only team that Carolina lost to this year where I left that game going, they were just a better team. There wasn't much we could do that night. They were just better at everything we were trying to do. They were kind of bullying us around. UNLV took that to a whole nother level. Like, I've never seen a team that just felt like they were grown men toying with boys, like, on a basketball court.
It was embarrassing.
It got to a point where CBS, literally the Saturday game in the afternoon was going to be UNLV, because they knew, and it didn't matter, UNLV was going to beat whoever by 25, and you knew it, and you were there to watch it. Like, that's what you wanted to see.
Beat Duke by 30
still
in the national title game with Christian Laettner, Grant Hill,
Bobby Hurley.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't think Grant Hill was on the first one. I think he was a freshman in 91, because that was kind of the difference. 91, 1993. Yeah. No, he wasn't on the 90 team that got beat by 30. But Hurley was. Leightner was. That's still the largest margin of victory in the NCAA tournament game. And we talked about this on Out of Pocket, Mike. That second half is known as the barrage, where literally UNLV came out and just shellac Duke with like 20 dunks, it felt like, just over and over and over, to the point where Bobby Hurley looks like he's about to start crying, like, on the court, because they just can't stop it. Like, it's just, it's so insane to watch them play. They had four first-round picks in the starting lineup. Larry Johnson was the number one overall pick, basically propped the Charlotte Hornets on his back for the next 4 or 5 years once he got out. And then, to be honest, the 91 team was better. I just can't pick them because they didn't win at all, because they lost to Duke in the rematch. And just Duke had to play the perfect game. And even playing the perfect game, Greg Anthony had to foul out, so there was no point guard on the floor. And even then, UNLV still had a chance to win the game. That's how good they were. You know, I mean, Duke had to play a flawless game just to be in the position to win, to beat UNLV. I've never seen anything like it. Carolina 09, they had some flaws. They had a large margin of victory going through the tournament as well. They're not even my favorite Carolina team, to be honest. My favorite Carolina team is 2017, just because of the journey they went on losing the year before. I've not cried at an ending of a basketball game except for maybe twice. And both times it was Carolina. 2016, the Villanova shot, you go from being here to being here in like 2 seconds. It's just a feeling you can't really describe. And then, well, actually, Kentucky fans, we did it to you the next year.
Well, I was getting ready to tell you, I've got a story, and I'll tell you off air because it's got some colorful language about that Carolina Kentucky Elite Eight game. Peyton was there; he'll verify. I'll tell you off air. Remind me. I know
it's gonna be like the video that's been on YouTube forever of like, it's like a sports bar or something. Yeah. There's a dude in the front, and he's cheering, and he's giving the finger and everything else, and they hit the shot, and he's like, yeah, and all you see is the crowd, and then like 2 seconds later, they're all like.
Just let me tell you, as a teaser, I had to do some home repairs after Luke made that shot pretty. On us.
It wasn't pretty.
By the way, I love that UNLV shout, and I even kind of mentioned him being one of the greatest teams. Stacey Ogman, Greg Anthony in the backcourt, yeah. Larry Johnson, Grandma Ma. I mean, man. I was only one at the time, but being a historian, my dad telling me about it, I've watched those teams a million times. I watched when they played Arkansas in the regular season. Arkansas was really good teams.
That was the number two team in the country.
One versus two. And that team was, and when I coach, they're one of those teams I grab inspiration from, because Tark would run and athletes and play ball. You know, those UNLV running Rebels teams from the mid to late 80s and the early 90s, phenomenal. Yeah.
Now, to be frank, UNLV was kind of a precursor to our next topic, because a lot of those teams that Tark built, he built them from getting guys from junior colleges. Like Larry Johnson came from a junior college. The team that he had before that was really, really good. I can't remember the dude's name that was the star on it. He came from a junior college. So he was kind of looking at D2 and junior colleges and stuff, almost like a transfer portal of sorts, and building these older teams with talent. And then the conference they were in, they could just run through it. And it just got to a point where it was just ridiculous at a certain point. So for me, it's 1990 UNLV. It would have been 91 UNLV as the greatest team of all time, in my opinion. But Duke kind of messed that whole thing up. That moves us over to our last segment of the day, is the transfer portal and NIL. Is it good or bad for college basketball? Because I'm seeing a lot of sentiment with fans, like, you know, just regular fans, like on Facebook and Twitter, when the news is announced that one of their players is leaving. It's like Seth Trimble entered the portal this week from Carolina. Not much of a surprise. He wasn't a starter, averaging 5 points per game. Ian Jackson's coming in. Elliott Cadeau staying. We don't even know if RJ Davis is leaving yet. So there's only one ball. So Seth decided to go. He was a top 50 recruit when he came out of high school. And he has that ability to. And to be honest, Hubert might have urged him to go. That's kind of how they got most of the team out of here last year. Hubert kind of gently nudged them out the door so he could get the roster spots available. Is it destroying college basketball, or is it a good thing for college basketball? Because for me, being an old school guy, I feel like college basketball is reverting back to what it was before the one and done era, where it's like the older teams, the more experienced teams are the ones that are going to be alive on Final Four weekend, which we just saw with Purdue, UConn, hell, NC State. That team was built in the transfer portal. Like, most of those kids didn't start off at NC State. Same with
Alabama.
Yeah. Alabama. Same way. They lost most of their talent last year. They went to portal and brought some of that back. You know, Brandon Miller is playing for the Hornets right now. He was in Alabama last year. Mm-hmm. So they've been able to build it that way. But then you see teams like Duke, who are still doing the one and done model. They're bringing in 6 freshmen next year, all highly rated freshmen, including Cooper Flagg, the number one recruit in the country. But they have yet to use the transfer portal really to kind of even things out. And I mentioned it earlier in the show. Maybe it's because it's hard to transfer credits into Duke. Like, that could be an issue that they don't really talk about. Duke is a highly regarded academic school. It might not be that easy to transfer credits in, and maybe that's why they don't use the portal. But because of that, doesn't it make it where Duke now is at an unfair advantage? Whereas before, they could kind of do all this without these rules in place and be in the same spot as Kentucky and Kansas, where they're kind of the kings of the one and done and bringing in these NBA talent. And the kids are coming because it's almost like a turnstile. They can get to the NBA quicker. But now it's like between COVID, NIL, and the portal, kids are staying longer. And the ones that were fringe players to begin with into the pros, they're saying, I can make money playing basketball and being big man on campus at Carolina for an extra year. I never understood why people make fun of Armando Bacot. Why in the world, if you can stay at Carolina, be big man on campus, it's 60% female on campus at Carolina. You're a super senior. You don't have to go to class. You're already pretty much graduated. You're getting paid to play basketball at Carolina instead of playing for the Greensboro Swarm in the G League. Yeah. And you're probably making a lot more. Like, what's the problem here? He's 25. Like,
and I agree with that. So there's two trains of thought, right? I think the NIL transfer portal combo is, as an idea, is great. As execution, and this goes back to NCAA where they don't have a clue what they're doing, it's been terribly executed.
They as in college basketball as a whole?
Like, yeah, as a whole. Sorry, specifics, yes. Yeah. We've been vouching for years for the kids to get paid. Going back to, you hear Jalen Rose and Fab Five and all of them talking about this famous story about, we'll go out in front of 15,000 people, the number one team in the country. You know, we've got celebrities at our game. And then we go to the bookstore and we see our jerseys with our names on them being sold for $80 a piece. We got nothing of it. But if somebody wants to buy us a pizza, we're in trouble. So we've been a voucher of kids getting paid. I mean, that's what they are, right? They're driving revenue. They should get paid.
Yeah.
And the transfer portal, I think, was meant to be a good idea. And I'm not totally against it because I'm with you. College basketball has been really good again with older kids. And Armando Bacot, for one, he didn't really have a pro prospect. So why not stay at school at a place like Carolina? Be a dominant big, set records, get paid to play at Carolina. As opposed to, if this was 10 years ago, he would have felt compelled that, like, oh man, if I stay for a second year, they're going to think my draft stock's not any good because of this perception.
Which was always weird to me. That was always weird to me that perception was
and
there.
And that's an NBA problem. NBA starts realizing, like, hey, it's better for our game if older guys come in instead of these young kids, then that'll change. But that's their perception, the way they draft. But real quick, transfer portal is not a bad thing. I think kids should be allowed to, if it's not a good fit, it's not a good fit. Coaches are allowed to leave all the time. The problem is it's been incentivized so much now with the NIL that you got guys who are go to a place, maybe they play a lot, maybe they don't. Then they're like, ah, well, I deserve more. Maybe people's in their ear. I deserve more. I can get this amount of money. And they have a self-inflated sense of their worth, because we've heard stories of kids that's averaged like 5.2 points per game on really bad mid-majors hit the portal because they've got some like a 6'6 guard that shoots well, that thinks they need $100,000 from Kansas, Duke, Kentucky, and it's just not working. So the portal is all, and plus the first day the portal opens up and we have like 900 kids in the portal. And then a week later, it's 1,300 kids. Why are so many kids transferring? So I think that at some point the transfer portal needs to be overhauled to maybe you can't transfer. You have to stay at a school at least 2 years or something. Because the transfer portal is overwhelming, but as an idea, I like it. I just think it's got to be revamped a little bit.
I don't like that apparently you can do this multiple times, because Tyler Nichols back in the portal again. He was with Carolina, transferred out. We thought it was for family reasons, went to Virginia Tech, and now he's Devin in the portal again.
Four
and he's,
times.
Yeah, so it's like there's no limit or whatever. You just kind of bounce around based off of, it's almost like mercenary, you know, like
it really is.
Can pay me to do
it's
what
a hired
I do.
Gun.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know about all that. Now, a couple places, Hubert's kind of figured it out a little bit. He's had a couple times through the portal where he's pulled some gems out that you didn't expect, you know, Brady Manick, Harrison Ingram, Cormac Ryan, that kind of stuff. So I expect that kind of to continue. You just got to kind of know your team and what you're looking for. But then again, there's other teams that haven't done it. Like Duke, they haven't done it really. I think Ryan Young came in through the portal, if I'm not mistaken, a couple years ago.
Ryan Young.
Nobody last year.
Let's call it what it is. Modern day transfer portal paired with NIL is the equivalent of NBA free agency.
Yes.
That's all it is.
Exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. Let me get Peyton, let me get you in real quick here. Your thoughts on it, and then we'll get yours, Mike, before we get out of here.
I think NIL is good. I think transfer portal is good, but I agree. You should not be able to transfer multiple different spots and multiple different seasons. Like, people are coming. Like, Charlie Moore did this, like, 3-4 years ago. He started his career at Cal, spent 1 year there, transferred to Kansas, spent 1 year there, went to DePaul, and then he finished his career at Miami. He spent 4 years of college basketball, 4 different schools. You should not be allowed to do that. I do agree. You should be able to, if a coach leaves your program, retires, blah, 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 or there's something to do with your family and you want to be close to your family, then fine. You should be able to transfer. But continuously to transfer multiple different spots, I think it's a little extreme. NIL, I like the NIL. I think it's good. College athletes should get paid. I never expect them to be making millions of dollars like they are now. Like, AJ Storr has asked for $1 million for whoever he's going to go to. He had a good season at Wisconsin, but he's not an All-American. He didn't make all of Big Ten team this year, and he's asking for $1 million. Just like, even the NIL, I feel like, has been good, but it's ruined the passion of, like, some of these athletes coming out of the college. Because you have, like, Haley Van Lith. Look at her. She had a really good 3 years at Louisville. Really good 3 years. Really good success down there. 3 straight Elite 8s. She was a guard for Jeff Walls, who was really known for putting guards into the WNBA. She left that to chase the bag to go to the defending champion LSU. That didn't work out, and now she's back in the portal.
Yeah, and like her reputation has been a bit stained a bit too, because wasn't she guarding Caitlin Clark in that?
Got smoked. So yeah, it's like Caitlin ate her up too.
Yeah, I will, and that's a good segue before we get to Mike. I have noticed, especially this year, there are stars in women's college basketball. There aren't really stars in men's college basketball right now. Like, dudes, like, I know we talk about Donovan Clingan and Zach Edey and Baycott and yada, yada, yada. But they aren't, like, the star. Like, when we talked about Larry Johnson before, or Christian Laettner before, Jamal Mashburn, like, those were stars. Like, back when I was a kid, when I would sit down and watch a quadruple header Saturday on ACC Network or whatever, well, it was Jefferson Pilot Sports or whatever, you knew who the star was on every one of the 8 teams in the ACC. You were looking forward to seeing Kenny Anderson and Georgia Tech take on King Rice and J.R. Reed and those boys at Carolina. And then it was going to be Joe Smith and Maryland versus Tim Duncan and Wake Forest. Like they marqueted it like the NBA. Like,
where you got to stay with them each year. Yeah. You knew back then, for the most part, nobody was coming out early. They were staying 4 years. So you had year by year to watch these kids literally develop into grown men.
The transfer portal destroyed that. Like, now it's like, unless your team is like a team like Carolina, where they're keeping a core and they're still kind of recruiting too, so they're building 4-star kids to stay 3-4 years, which has been kind of their formula. Marcus Page was like that. Bryce Johnson was like that. They were a 4-star kid, so they weren't necessarily leaving after freshman year, and they ended up staying 4 years. And that's maybe what needs to get back to. Mike, what do you think here? Is it good or bad for college basketball?
I think there's pros and cons to it. I think Josh nailed it on the head that it's NBA free agency, which is bad. Like, kids already getting, like, free scholarships to classes, and, you know, other people are, you know, having to pay college loans for, you know, 10, 20 years sometimes. So they're already getting that free education. I do like the NIL is bringing back EA Sports college football. I miss that video game. Yeah. Every gamer just, like, sighed relief. It should be releasing this summer, and I'll hopefully get to pick it up and
bring back college hoops.
That would
be great. And Duke and the Cameron Crazies, if they can get that right. But I mean, I even as a Duke fan, people are surprised when I say this, but I kind of didn't like the one and done. I wish they, instead of doing the transfer portal or the NIL, which you should have a limit on the amount of money they can make, you should have a limit on the amount of times they can transfer out. I really wish they had done what college football and the NFL did, to where you need to be 3 years removed from high school to enter the draft. And I think that's an easy fix. You elevate the game of college basketball. You elevate the game of the NBA, and you allow all the games to have some sort of integrity behind it. So those are my thoughts. It's kind of fixed the one and done, but it hasn't fixed the entire issue. It almost feels like a Band-Aid.
Yeah, I agree with what you just said, Mike, with all of that. And it's almost like you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube once it's out. So now it's like, well, now what do you do? Because we kind of opened it all up, and now we're like, oh, gosh, maybe we opened it up too much. That rule, that was an NBA rule, wasn't it? So if anything, it's really up to the NBA to change it. And I think what they're doing is they're trying to proposition the G League to be where they can start letting high schoolers come back in again. And they would just automatically go to G League first, unless they're like a top 10 pick or a lottery pick or something to that effect. Maybe they protect it that way, or maybe they don't. They just let you come in and the teams decide where the players go. But if they go back to that again, that might be fine. I think the thing that gets lost in the sauce is that usually each year there's really only like four or five kids out of high school to even stand a chance to be good in the pros right off the bat. Like that was like that back in the 90s when you could do it. You know, that's why a lot of them didn't, because it just wasn't, it wasn't a young guy's game. Like you, your prime in the NBA is really 27 to 34. If you have a pretty long career, that's really when you hit your prime. And if you're 18 coming into the league, now it's a little different because the league is younger. And I think the play reflects that. But when it was older, there was more banging, there was more defense. People weren't afraid to touch each other. You know what I mean? Like you get down in the paint, bang around, and it was a harder game to play. With the younger guys that are now infiltrating in the league in the NBA, I think it's more spaced out and it's more threes. Like, it's nothing to see an NBA team attempt 53 pointers in a game, which to me is just insanity. Like, I get it, three is more than two, but that's just nuts to just come down and just not even on a play, jack a 30-foot three. If it goes in, great. If not, it's all right. We'll just come back and try again in a little bit when the other team tries a three. So
analytics, man. I'd go at a whole podcast on analytics, drive me insane. They have always been a tool to use, not the rule. A tool, not the rule. And too many people in our sport, the basketball as a whole, try to live by it as a rule and try to tell you that like a mid-range jump shot is a low percentage shot. Well, I'm sorry, MJ, Kobe,
Michael Jordan,
Duncan, Dirk.
That's why Kawhi Leonard's so good. Kawhi Leonard's the best in the game right now at the mid-range. Like, it's a lost art. If you see those charts of like where people are shooting like nowadays, it's all around the three-point line and all in the paint. Nobody shoots at the mid-range anymore. Like, it's Kawhi George, and that's it. Even LeBron's mainly taking threes when he's out there. Like, it's gotten out of hand, but that's probably a topic for another day because we are at the end of this. This went by super fast. Great show. Want to thank Josh and Peyton Burton for stopping by. Go check out the Everything College Basketball podcast. I'm sure they're gonna still be putting shows out even though the season is over. Follow them on their YouTube channel. Of course, you can catch Michael Davis Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday live 12:30 p.m. on Out of Pocket with Michael Davis right here on Tobacco Road Sports Radio's YouTube channel. And y'all know where y'all can find me. I'm all over the place. Out of Pocket, this Believe in Panthers podcast with Jonathan Stewart and Skylar Callahan on a little bit of a break. We should be back next week. But that's it for Franchise Players. We'll check you out next Friday.